Chapter 15. The Slave, the Quaker, and the Panopticon. "Disguise thyself as thou wilt, still, slavery," said I, "still, thou art a bitter draught." Lawrence Stern, A Sentimental Journey Through France and Italy. As Elkanah Watson neared Mount Vernon in 1785, he could scarcely contain his excitement. He recalled, "I had feasted my imagination for several days in the near prospect of a visit to Mount Vernon, the seat of Washington. No pilgrim ever approached Mecca with deeper enthusiasm." A young merchant from Massachusetts, Watson was not disappointed. He was impressed with the general's physical bearing as well as the expressive quality of his face. "I observed a peculiarity in his smile, which seemed to illuminate his eye. His whole countenance beamed with intelligence, while it commanded confidence and respect." Writing up the story of his visit to Mount Vernon, Watson called the time he spent there, "two of the richest days of my life." In his reminiscence, Watson seems almost awestruck by his host's presence. He found Washington reaping the reward of his illustrious deeds in the quiet shade of his beloved retirement. He was at the matured age of 53. Alexander and Caesar both died before they reached that period of life, and both had immortalized their names. How much stronger and nobler the claims of Washington to immortality! Watson did not come to Mount Vernon empty-handed. He had recently returned from a trip to England, where he had befriended Granville Sharp, a prominent British philanthropist and vehement anti-slavery advocate. Learning about Watson's plan to visit Mount Vernon, Sharp gave him some political pamphlets to present to Washington, whom he saw as the most influential man in America. Placing pamphlets in Washington's hands, Sharp hoped, would help spread his ideas for legal, political, and social reform across the United States. The package consisted of two bundles of books embracing Sharp's thoughts on what Watson called congenial topics. Watson does not clarify what he meant by congenial, but the surviving pamphlets discuss such diverse subjects as constitutional law, due process, ethics, parliamentary reform, public property, representative government, and slavery. 1. The Law of Retribution presents a detailed indictment of slavery. It is an angry work. The title page sternly warns readers, threatening God's vengeance against all tyrants, slaveholders, and oppressors. With the Law of Retribution, Sharp's hope that Washington would assimilate his ideas and spread his message fell flat. The pamphlet was so off-putting that Washington set it aside, seeing no reason to read beyond the title page. His copy of the Law of Retribution verifies that he never read it. The pages remain uncut. Perhaps Washington did not need to read the work. The Law of Retribution was largely obsolete by the time he received a copy from Watson. Sharp's anti-slavery message remained valid, of course, but his dire prediction that the practice of slavery would destroy the British Empire no longer applied. Sharp had written the pamphlet soon after Lexington and Concord. Now that the Revolutionary War was over, his prediction had come true. Great Britain had lost a big chunk of its empire. But the loss of the American colonies was not due to slavery. Washington may not have read Sharp's Appendix to the Representation, either. Another pamphlet on slavery in the bundles of books Watson delivered, Sharp's Appendix supplements an earlier work, a representation of the injustice and dangerous tendency of tolerating slavery. At first glance, Sharp's appendix might seem incomprehensible to readers who did not know the work it appended. Actually, Appendix to the Representation marks a significant departure from Representations of the Injustice. It stands on its own as an impassioned plea for the abolition of slavery based on what one contemporary reader called arguments drawn from law, reason, and humanity. In addition, Sharp added a religious component to his critique of slavery, something absent from Representation of the Injustice. Though Sharp's pamphlets on slavery did not appeal to Washington, the topic was entering the conversation more and more at Mount Vernon, a place that over 100 slaves called home. Touring the grounds, visitors could hardly avoid thinking about slavery, given its place in Washington's house and throughout his plantation. The presence of slaves often seemed incongruous at the home of the man who had fought and won American freedom. On either side of his bright and spacious greenhouse, Washington built two wings, which provided cramped, poorly lit quarters for many slaves. Shrewd visitors have noticed that the orange trees had it better than the slaves. Wherever they went on the grounds of Mount Vernon, people could witness slaves at work. Watson was one of many visitors who saw fit to bring up the subject in conversation. In terms of the activities of its slaves, Mount Vernon was in a transitional period, at least compared with other plantations in the South. The shift from tobacco to wheat and other staple crops in the 1760s had made Washington less dependent on slave labor than many Virginia planters, giving his slaves the opportunity to undertake tasks that involved more skill and greater training. No slave was more visible than Billy Lee. The veterans who came to Mount Vernon remembered him well, and those who had never met Billy had heard about his wartime exploits in General Washington's service. After the war, Billy had suffered some debilitating injuries, breaking one knee in 1785, leaving him partly lame, and breaking the other knee 3 years later. To continue to be useful, Billy began cobbling shoes. No matter what he was doing when visitors arrived, Billy Lee typically offered a friendly greeting. G.W.P. Custis's pen portrait of Billy captures his affable spirit, but, written in the heyday of the plantation novel, it comes dangerously close to racial stereotype. Billy carefully reconnoitered the visitors as they arrived, and when a military title was announced, the old body servant would send his compliments to the soldier, requesting an interview at his quarters. It was never denied, and Billy, after receiving a warm grasp of the hand, would say, "Ah, Colonel, glad to see you. We of the Army don't see one another often in these peaceful times. Glad to see Your Honor looking so well. Remember you at headquarters. The new time people don't know what we old soldiers did and suffered for the country in the old war. Was it not cold enough at Valley Forge? Yes, was it, and I am sure you remember it was hot enough at Monmouth. Ah, Colonel, I am a poor cripple. Can't ride now, so I make shoes and think of the old times. The general often stops his horse here to inquire if I want anything. I want for nothing, thank God, but the use of my limbs." Since returning from the war, Washington had been devoting much thought to the issue of slavery. The Reverend Francis Asbury, a Methodist minister who visited the same year as Elkanah Watson, found the master of Mount Vernon expressing his opinion against slavery. When William Gordon was at Mount Vernon researching the history of the Revolutionary War, he and Washington discussed the possibility of emancipating his slaves. Washington told Gordon that someday he hoped to eliminate slavery at Mount Vernon altogether. The other tracts on slavery in Washington's personal library, those that do show signs of reading, provide a rough guide to his attitude. The earliest tract at Mount Vernon that broached the theme of emancipation dates from 1774, but Washington did have one earlier pamphlet in his collection that took African-American slavery as its subject, a letter to an American planter from his friend in London. First printed in 1771, the work was reprinted 10 years later to distribute in Antigua. Several copies of the second edition survive, but Washington's is only one of two copies of the first edition to survive in the United States. Both editions of A Letter to an American Planter from His Friend in London appeared anonymously. John Van Horn has identified John Waring as its author. Waring was secretary to the Associates of the late Reverend Dr. Bray, an organization formed to continue Bray's vigorous philanthropic efforts. For this pamphlet, Waring assumed the persona of a London friend offering advice to an American planter regarding how to treat his slaves. In his letter, the London friend suggests that the planter could mitigate the condition of his slaves by converting them to Christianity. Waring's argument constitutes an impassioned plea for racial equality. Regardless of the color of their skin, people's souls are equal in the eyes of God. Though well-intentioned, Waring somewhat undermined his plea for equality when he denigrated the idolatrous rites and practices slaves had brought with them from Africa, finding those traditional customs ridiculous. By accepting Christianity, Waring argued, slaves will assure themselves of more humane, benevolent treatment. Upon its publication, Waring shipped 40 copies of this pamphlet to a Virginia friend, Robert Carter Nicholas. More than 2 years later, Waring sent Nicholas a follow-up letter, wondering whether the bundle of pamphlets had ever arrived. Since Waring had never received a letter from Nicholas acknowledging their receipt, he assumed they had been lost in transit. The fact that Washington had a copy in his library at Mount Vernon confirms that the pamphlets did arrive. Other evidence reveals the whereabouts of an additional copy. The estate inventory of Dabney Carr, Thomas Jefferson's brother-in-law, lists a copy of Letter to an American Planter. Upon receiving the bundle of 40 copies, Nicholas apparently distributed individual pamphlets to friends and fellow members of the Virginia House of Burgesses. The beginning of Washington's interest in the anti-slavery cause has been dated between the late 1760s to the mid-1780s. Some place it around the time of the Declaration of Independence. Others suggest he did not become deeply engaged in the issue of slavery until the time of the Constitutional Convention. That he received this pamphlet around 1771 and kept his copy while other Virginians disposed of theirs supports the argument that his engagement with the anti-slavery issue began early during the Revolutionary period. Other people in colonial Virginia also grew concerned about slavery during the early 1770s, wondering if there were any essential differences between Africans and Englishmen. Samuel Henley, for one, questioned whether people from Europe and Africa really differed at all. After settling in Williamsburg to take a professorship at the College of William and Mary, Henley had the chance to test the acuity of some African slaves. He asked one of them how it happened that, as Adam and Eve were white, he, their descendant, should be black. "I don't know," the man replied, "but prick your hand and prick mine. My blood is as red as yours." Henley was delighted with this response. It reminded him of a scene in The Merchant of Venice, in which the Prince of Morocco, one of Portia's suitors, pleads with her, arguing that she should not be prejudiced against him solely because of the color of his skin. "Bring me the fairest creature northward born," he implores, "and let us make incision for your love, to prove whose blood is reddest, his or mine." The perceptive reply from this Virginia slave, echoing Shakespeare no less, prompted Henley to reconsider the essence of European and African, colonist and slave. In the political discourse of the Revolutionary era, American patriots likened their own oppression under British colonial rule to slavery. The pamphleteers and polemicists who made their case emphasized the natural rights of the American colonists by comparing them to slaves held in bondage. During the years leading to the Revolution, they clamored for freedom from the chains of British tyranny. All this talk of freedom emboldened those who spoke for the African slaves in America. In writing Letter to an American Planter, Waring had sought to ameliorate the condition of the slaves, but stopped short of arguing for emancipation. The pamphleteers who came after him would make the case for freeing the slaves. Washington himself may have begun talking about emancipation as early as 1774, when he went to Philadelphia as a delegate to the First Continental Congress. Almost surely he met Anthony Benezet, the Quaker activist known throughout the city for his efforts to enlist others to various causes, peace, temperance, and emancipation. Benezet worked tirelessly toward the complete and total eradication of slavery. Recalling his own experience in the City of Brotherly Love, the Marquis de Barbet-Marbois, the head of the French legation there, exclaimed, "Who could have lived a month in Philadelphia without knowing Anthony Benezet?" The arrival of major political figures from throughout the colonies for the First Continental Congress gave Benezet an ideal platform for conveying his anti-slavery message to the most powerful men in America. Benezet had a busy network of Quaker correspondents across the colonies. To facilitate his contact with the Virginia delegates to the First Continental Congress, Benezet's friend Robert Pleasance, a prominent Virginia Quaker, wrote a letter of introduction for the entire contingent. After naming them, Pleasance suggested that most, perhaps all, of the Virginia delegates were sympathetic to the Quakers and would appreciate his friendship. Benezet left a detailed account of his conversation with Patrick Henry. Presumably, he also spoke with other Virginia delegates. One volume in Washington's library provides crucial evidence to indicate that he and Benezet did meet in Philadelphia. Whereas most bound volumes of pamphlets at Mount Vernon consisted of ones Washington received separately and arranged to have bound, this particular volume contains two separately published pamphlets, which Benezet had combined into a single volume, subjoining them with a common title page, "The Potent Enemies of America Laid Open." Besides being a pioneer in the fight against slavery, Benezet was also a pioneer of what is now called custom publishing. He would often have printed a general title page, which he used for different collections of pamphlets. Benezet thus customized the contents of each volume of tracts he presented, piggybacking one cause onto another. The Potent Enemies of America shows up in the libraries of other delegates to the First Continental Congress, including Robert Treat Paine and Roger Sherman. Apparently, Benezet presented copies to several congressional delegates. The first pamphlet in Washington's copy of this custom-made collection has an imposing title, "The Mighty Destroyer Displayed, in Some Account of the Dreadful Havoc Made by the Mistaken Use as Well as Abuse of Distilled Spirituous Liquors." Benezet edited the text himself, using his own prose to connect pertinent quotations from several medical experts on the subject of alcohol abuse. The Philadelphia edition of John Wesley's Thoughts Upon Slavery forms the second pamphlet in the volume. Wesley first published Thoughts Upon Slavery in London in 1774. The ever-industrious Benezet prepared the Philadelphia edition himself and published it before the year's end. Editing the work for American readers, he added many explanatory notes to Thoughts Upon Slavery, making Wesley's arguments as urgent and pertinent as possible. Serious Considerations on Several Important Subjects, another one of Anthony Benezet's works that could be found at Mount Vernon, came to Washington as a present from Warner Mifflin, a Delaware Quaker who, like Benezet, advocated peace, and worked toward the abolition of slavery. A slave owner himself, Mifflin gradually understood that it was a sin of a deep dye to enslave his fellow man, so he freed his in 1774. Mifflin's emancipation of his slaves set an example, and other slave-holding Quakers followed suit and freed theirs. Washington may have met this Delaware Quaker during the Revolutionary War, when Mifflin developed a reputation for his anti-war activities. His story became well known in Europe, mainly because Crèvecoeur retold it at length in Letters from an American Farmer. English readers should not rush to their copies of Crèvecoeur. The Mifflin chapter appears only in the French text, which was widely disseminated across Europe. After reading the story in the French edition of Letters from an American Farmer, Brissot de Warville labeled Mifflin the Angel of Peace. Once the German playwright Auguste von Kotzebue read Crèvecoeur, he adapted Mifflin's war story as a one-act play, The Quaker. According to Crèvecoeur, whose account of Warner Mifflin falls somewhere between an embellishment of facts and an outright fabrication, the Quaker yearly meeting chose Mifflin to fulfill a mission of peace. During the Battle of Germantown, he supposedly braved the dangers of the battlefield and crossed the British lines to speak with General Howe, urging him to find a peaceful solution to the conflict between the United States and Great Britain. Mifflin subsequently returned to the American side and spoke with General Washington, delivering a similar message. Washington appreciated Mifflin's courage and candor, but told him that both sides were long since past a peaceful solution. With the war's end, Mifflin resumed his anti-slavery efforts, presenting several petitions to the First Federal Congress and urging the legislators to take measures toward the abolition of slavery. During Washington's presidency, Mifflin visited him to see if he could exert any pressure on behalf of the anti-slavery cause. After much general conversation, Washington wrote in his diary, Mifflin used arguments to show the immorality, injustice, and impolicy of keeping these people in a state of slavery, with declarations, however, that he did not wish for more than a gradual abolition, or to see any infraction of the Constitution to effect it. Though Washington privately looked forward to the abolition of slavery, he remained diplomatic in his reply to Mifflin, hesitating to commit himself one way or the other, since this matter could very well require him to make an official decision in the not-too-distant future. Short Observations on Slavery, another one of Benezet's pamphlets at Mount Vernon, excerpts the Abbé Raynal's thoughts on the subject, which Benezet ties together with his own opinions. Benezet's remarks in this pamphlet are among his angriest and most unforgiving. He castigates the practice of compensating slave owners whose runaways are killed by slave hunters, suggesting that it is tantamount to government-sanctioned murder. No one associated with slavery escapes Benezet's vitriol. Slave owners who place the blame on slave traders rationalize their behavior. There could be no slave traders without slave owners. People who inherited slaves or acquired them through charitable means were as guilty for perpetuating slavery as those who bought them. The practice of slavery, Benezet continued, corrupted American youth and undermined the moral fiber of the nation. Washington's connections with the Quaker community acquainted him with other anti-slavery literature. In A Serious Address to the Rulers of America on the Inconsistency of Their Conduct Respecting Slavery, David Cooper, a leading New Jersey Quaker, addressed the contradiction between the freedom the American Revolution represented and the ongoing practice of slavery. Cooper published his pamphlet pseudonymously, signing himself simply, A Farmer. Cooper spoke with so much passion and conviction that some readers thought Benazet had written a serious address. Cooper proclaimed, "Now is the time to demonstrate to Europe, to the whole world, that America was in earnest and meant what she said when, with particular energy and unanswerable reasoning, she pled the cause of human nature and with undaunted firmness insisted that all mankind came from the hand of their Creator equally free." Stressing that all men and women are governed by natural law, Cooper stated, "With equal justice may Negroes say, by the immutable laws of nature, we are equally entitled to life, liberty, and property with our lordly masters." He aggressively circulated his pamphlet, presenting copies to several members of the Continental Congress. Benazet was so impressed with the work that he helped Cooper distribute it. Writing in 1785, Robert Pleasance delivered a message similar to the one Cooper expressed in A Serious Address. Among the Virginia Quakers, Pleasance was an exemplary figure. He, too, had freed his slaves, hiring them back as free men and women and paying them wages for their work. He also supported a school to educate free black children. In a personal letter, Pleasance reminded Washington, "Remember, the cause for which thou wert called to the command of the American army was the cause of liberty and the rights of mankind. How strange, then, must it appear to impartial thinking men to be informed that many who were warm advocates for that noble cause during the war are now sitting down in a state of ease, dissipation, and extravagance on the labor of slaves." Pleasance suggested that Washington could have as much impact on African-American freedom as he had had on American freedom. "Thy example and influence at this time, towards a general emancipation, would be as productive of real happiness to mankind as thy sword may have been." Along with this letter, Pleasance sent Washington a copy of a pamphlet by Robert Bell, Illuminations for Legislators and for Sentimentalists. A grab bag full of essays, this collection contained extracts from many previously published works, including John Dickinson's Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer. Bell titled the excerpt from Dickinson, Sentiments on What is Freed and What is Slavery. Dickinson's text does not really have anything to do with the practice of slavery in America. The fact that Pleasant sent Bell's pamphlet with his anti-slavery letter does not suggest a curious reversal in the political discourse. During the Revolutionary era, the plight of the American colonists under the yoke of British tyranny was compared to slavery. Now, the plight of slaves in the United States was likened to the former situation of the American colonists. The slaves needed to follow the pattern established by the colonists to secure their freedom from tyranny. In 1786, Washington took a census of his slaves at Mount Vernon and his outlying plantations. He counted a total of 216 slaves. About half belonged to him. The rest were dower slaves, meaning they were the property of his wife, which he held in trust for the Custis heirs. Around this same time, Washington wrote privately, "It is among my first wishes to see some plan adopted by which slavery in this country may be abolished by slow, sure, and imperceptible degrees." Washington continued to ponder the situation and add books on the subject to his library, including the Philadelphia edition of Thomas Clarkson's Essay on the Impolicy of the African Slave Trade. There's no telling how Washington acquired this work. It may have been another present from a Quaker correspondent. When Warner Mifflin and other Quakers petitioned the first federal Congress to pass legislation against slavery, one of the first instances of organized political lobbying in Congress, they informed the lawmakers of their position partly by sending Congress a small library of anti-slavery literature, which included Clarkson's Essay on the Impolicy of the African Slave Trade. The Mount Vernon copy of Clarkson caught the attention of others. Once David Humphreys returned to America from Paris, he became a fixture at the Washington home, staying there for extended periods of time. Humphreys took advantage of Washington's library, something other guests did as well. During a visit to Mount Vernon, the Marquis de Lafayette spent time in his host's library reading books written during his absence. Humphreys similarly found much to read in Washington's library. In a surviving notebook, he summarized several works he read at Mount Vernon, including Clarkson's essay. The notebook also reveals that Humphreys and Washington discussed Clarkson's work. Shortly after summarizing the book, Humphreys transcribed something Washington had said about slavery. Since Humphreys used direct discourse to record Washington's comments, they lend a sense of immediacy to the account in his notebook. "The unfortunate condition of the persons whose labor in part I employed," Washington admitted, "has been the only unavoidable subject of regret. To make the adults among them as easy and as comfortable in their circumstance as their actual state of ignorance and improvidence would admit, and to lay a foundation to prepare the rising generation for a destiny different from that in which they were born, afforded some satisfaction to my mind, and could not, I hoped, be displeasing to the justice of the Creator." That he recorded these words in direct discourse does not necessarily mean Humphreys transcribed the precise words Washington had spoken. Don't forget, he rendered Washington's resignation speech to the Confederation Congress in heroic couplets. But the comments Humphreys has his friend and mentor say on this occasion jibe with remarks Washington made on other occasions. More and more, Washington understood that something had to be done about slavery. The optimistic, forward-thinking remarks Washington made in conversation with Humphreys indicate that he was already thinking about emancipation. Another book from Washington's library Humphreys read and summarized was Adam Smith's Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. Presumably, this work entered his conversation with Washington, who read the work thoroughly himself. Washington's surviving copy contains a characteristic correction that reveals him in the process of reading. On the subject of grain prices in both Scotland and England, Smith offered evidence to prove how expensive grain used to be. "The price of grain in Scotland," Smith observed, "is supported by the evidence of the public fiars, annual valuations made upon oath according to the actual state of the markets, of all the different sorts of grain in every different county of Scotland." In his copy of the work, Washington corrected fiars to fairs, but his zeal for perfection led him astray in this instance. Unique to Scotland, fiars is a real word meaning annually fixed prices of grain. Reading Smith's text with Washington's correction, Joseph Wharton, who later owned the book, noted at the bottom of the page, "The above alteration from fiars to fairs was perhaps made by Washington, but fiars is the word intended by the author. It means the price of grain as fixed in each Scotch county by the sheriff and a jury." As the foremost economic treatise of the era, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations surveys many different aspects of the economy, including slavery. Smith had spoken against slavery earlier. In his Theory of Moral Sentiments, one of the ethical treatises Washington had purchased for Jack Custis in 1773, Smith observes, "There is not a Negro from the coast of Africa who does not possess a degree of magnanimity which the soul of his sordid master is scarce capable of conceiving." Smith's comments on slavery in The Wealth of Nations take a different tack. Instead of expressing moral outrage, he now treats the issue of slavery with pragmatism. His remarks are so pragmatic, in fact, that they border on cynicism. He critiqued slavery's economic inefficiency with a simple fact: people want property. property provides an incentive to work and thus forms a basis for economic efficiency. By preventing slaves from owning property, the system of chattel slavery denied them the incentive to work. The system also made slaveholders reluctant to free their slaves, who would willfully relinquish property they owned. Having learned about some Pennsylvania Quakers who had resolved to free their slaves, Smith dared to question their magnanimity. The late resolution of the Quakers in Pennsylvania to set at liberty all their Negro slaves may satisfy us that their number cannot be very great. Had they made any considerable part of their property, such a resolution could never have been agreed to. To end slavery, Smith concluded, abolitionists must appeal to self-interest. David Humphreys's presence contributed greatly to the talk about books and literature that occurred at Mount Vernon, but he was not the only friend who had become a part of Washington's household. Looking for someone to serve as both private secretary for himself and domestic tutor for Nellie and Wash Custis, George Washington welcomed Tobias Lear to Mount Vernon. A Harvard graduate with a proficiency in French, Lear had the skills to fill the dual position of secretary and teacher. The letters of recommendation Washington received on his behalf speak of Lear's excellent education, goodness of heart, honor, integrity, and modesty. Lear arrived at Mount Vernon the last week of May, 1786. Washington was impressed with him from the start, finding him a genteel, well-behaved young man. He would remain an important part of Washington's life for years to come. As part of his effort to organize the library at Mount Vernon, Washington collected and arranged many of the loose pamphlets and sent them to his bookbinder. Handsomely bound in tree calf, a type of leather binding decorated to resemble wood grain, the resulting volumes made beautiful additions to his library shelves. Many of these volumes are miscellaneous, but a few contain additional works on slavery. One pamphlet volume that survives from Washington's library, for example, contains Proceedings of the Honorable House of Assembly of Jamaica on the Sugar and Slave Trade, one of the few works in Washington's library that spoke in defense of slavery, but none of the other pamphlets in the volume concern the subject. The binder's title simply designates the volume as Miscellanies. Some of the pamphlet volumes from Mount Vernon do collect works treating the same subject. One surviving volume has the spine title Tracts on Slavery. In addition to the works by Clarkson and Cooper, it contains several other pamphlets, including one titled Oration Upon the Moral and Political Evil of Slavery, which its author, George Buchanan, had delivered in Baltimore on the 4th of July, 1791, at a meeting of the Maryland Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery and the Relief of Free Negroes and Others Unlawfully Held in Bondage. When Jefferson Davis visited the Boston Athenaeum in 1858, he had the opportunity to examine this volume. Buchanan's oration astonished him. The librarian vividly captured Davis's reaction. Nothing so fixed his attention as this. He read it and expressed himself amazed. He had heard that such sentiments were expressed at the South, but had never seen them. Several additional anti-slavery pamphlets from Washington's library are bound together in another surviving volume. It contains John Waring's Letter to an American Planter from his Friend in London, and three works by Anthony Benezet. Besides Serious Considerations and Short Observations, it also includes Benezet's Notes on the Slave Trade, an 8-page pamphlet repeating comments Benezet had made in Serious Considerations. What makes this particular pamphlet volume stand out is its first work, Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon. Did the bookbinder choose to group all these titles together, or was Washington the one who chose which pamphlets belonged together? The subject of slavery links together the other pamphlets in the volume. Did Washington recognize a continuity between the tracts against slavery and Bentham's Panopticon? In the broadest sense, Bentham's Panopticon and the late 18th century anti-slavery discourse concern power, specifically how people in power maintain control over others. With his Panopticon concept, Bentham devised a way to keep inmates of any penal institution under continual surveillance. An observation tower would be located at the center of a prison, and the inmate cells would radiate outward from it. Prisons constructed along the Panopticon plan would let guards easily keep all the prisoners under their watchful gaze. Though Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon largely concerns the organization of prisons and the observation of prisoners, the work was inspired by his brother Samuel's experience in Russia. A naval engineer, Samuel Bentham oversaw a large workforce at the shipyards consisting of skilled British shipbuilders and unskilled Russian serfs, or in other words, free and forced labor. Recent critical discussion has emphasized the Panopticon's use for incarceration. Grouping Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon with several anti-slavery tracts, Washington's pamphlet volume returns the concept to its original context. Jeremy Bentham adds something that is largely absent from the other works in the volume and the anti-slavery literature in general. Speaking for the slaves, that is, men and women subjected to the power of their owners, the anti-slavery advocates argued that they should be freed and consequently empowered. Though recognizing the injustice of slavery and the need to eliminate it, they remained somewhat vague in terms of practical solutions. Their idealism is inspiring, but the anti-slavery advocates are a little short on practical solutions. Bentham, whose name is synonymous with pragmatism, devised an ingenious way to supervise workers, which could be applied to many different forms of labor. This particular pamphlet volume, which straddles the pragmatic and the idealistic, prompts some questions about where Washington stood. If he freed his slaves, what would happen to them? He would still need workers at Mount Vernon. Could he adopt a plan along the lines of the one Robert Pleasance used after freeing his slaves? Would former slaves, once freed, continue to work for him? If so, how could he supervise them? When Washington had designed his gardens at Mount Vernon, he had started with Batty Langley's elaborate plans and radically simplified them to suit the local conditions. Could he similarly adapt Bentham's Panopticon for the purpose of plantation management? Washington never answered these questions, but after much reading, discussion, and contemplation, he decided to free his slaves in his will. He could do nothing about the dower slaves, which would descend in the Custis family, but he could free the slaves he owned outright. When he wrote his will, he made provisions for them. Billy Lee received special treatment. Washington gave him the choice of immediate freedom or a lasting home at Mount Vernon. Either way, he provided Billy with a substantial annuity as a testimony, he wrote, of my sense of his attachment to me and for his faithful services during the Revolutionary War. With his other slaves, he devised a system for their gradual emancipation after his wife's death. When the details of Washington's will became public after his death, the Quaker community rejoiced. Not only did Washington's will free his slaves, it also provided for those who were too young or too elderly to work, and for educating the young and giving welfare to the elderly. Indirectly, it could be said, Washington did adapt Bentham's Panopticon to control the slaves he freed. The best way to assure that free men and women behave responsibly is not to keep them under constant surveillance, but to educate them. Nothing can assure responsible behavior more than an educated citizenry.